Well, Imani, welcome. I'm Ian Campbell from Palliative Care Australia in Canberra on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples. Welcome to Thursdays at 3, our regular series of conversations with people living and working at the end of life. We've had some big conversations in this season of the podcast. We take that up a notch today with a man who has spent a life advocating for children. So Albert Ainslie Green has over 40 years' experience of working with governments and organisations worldwide, being a voice for children. He was the first Children's Commissioner of England, has been a clinical lecturer in adult and paediatric medicine at the University of Oxford, and is the best-selling author of The British Betrayal of Childhood. In 2006, he was knighted by Queen Elizabeth for his services to children and young people. Underpinning Al's work is his own personal story through childhood, and in more recent times, the death of his beloved life partner, Rosemary. Joining us from the UK, Sir Albert Ainslie Green. A real pleasure to spend this time with you, Al. Welcome.
Well, good morning, Ian, and hello to everybody who may be watching and listening to us. It's a delight to be with you. And as Ian says, I'm talking from England, from the beautiful cathedral city of Salisbury and the southwest of England, and I'm in the library of my Tudor house that was built in 1594. And it still has the 16th century drafts in it in the wintertime. It's a lovely, cold, late summer morning here in Salisbury. And you may know, it's only recently I've returned from Australia. I had a phenomenal 1 month lecture tour of Australia, Perth, Melbourne, Brisbane, Darwin, Broome, back to Perth, and meeting many, many people, particularly in Melbourne and in Perth. And I was blown away by the quality of the discussions I had in Melbourne with medical students who are pushing forward their agenda on death and dying, where medical students are being taught how to communicate by working with actors who portray dying people and the relatives of dying people. And the young people are videoed doing this to improve their communication skills around death and dying. Now, this is something truly wonderful. And I'm trying my best to disseminate news of this because we need this worldwide. And then in Perth, I was also blown away by truly wonderful people in the palliative care team there in Perth Children's Hospital. And it was through them I was put in touch with you, of course. So I hear a lot about the quality of the thinking and the care that's going on in Australia. And I celebrate it. And I want to say very well done to every one of you.
Al, I'm looking forward to unpacking your recent trip to Australia, and indeed your presence here really energised the palliative care community. We've got lots to talk about, and of course, apart from your recent trip to Australia, you've got a new job. I've just gone through just a small part of your CV, but tell us about your new job.
Well, more detail about me can be found on my website, ainsleygreen.com. But yes, 3 months ago, I was appointed the first ever and so far the only professor of compassionate care in the UK. And I'll tell you why I come to that in just a moment. But I'm using it as an academic platform, a credible platform, to confront what I see to be the mismatch between the wonders of medical science and the erosion of the humanity of care in our services. And that was the theme for my lecture tour across Australia, putting compassion back into compassionate care. So what does this mean for your community in palliative care is the exam question for me this morning.
Albert, that academic lens you bring to compassionate care, often compassionate care is warm, it's fuzzy, it's cuddly, it's hard to quantify. Is that why you're bringing this academic lens to it, that we need to quantify the benefits of being kind, of being compassionate, of having empathy?
No, you're absolutely right, Ian. And I think the community is using five words, and they're using them as synonyms, but they're not synonyms. And we're talking about compassion, we're talking about empathy, sympathy, love, and kindness. Those are the five key words in my lexicon for the humanity of care, but they mean different things. And by far the most powerful of those words, which is why I'm focusing on, is compassion. What do we mean by compassion? It means putting ourselves in the shoes of others and doing something about it. Mm-hmm. That's why it's different to empathy. Empathy is just putting yourself in the shoes of others. So compassion is an active word. I know it can be taught. I know it can be measured. I know it can be audited, and it needs to be embedded in every organization dealing with people towards the end of life.
And now, is proving the tangible benefits of compassion part of your work, part of your challenge?
Yes. I'm wanting to explore what compassion actually means. How do we teach it? How do we audit it? How do we look at impact? Could we possibly do any harm as a result of a focus on compassion? These are the sorts of questions I want you to toss around, and I'm really keen to get your feedback across your network on what I'm saying. So the first question to you is, do you think that compassion is needed in Australia?
Absolutely. And I think many will be surprised to hear that health systems, health leadership is lacking compassion. I guess in many ways we assume compassion is innate. We're born with compassion, we're born with empathy, and people who are drawn to a health career innately have it. But that's not the case by the sound of things.
It certainly is not the case. And there are many reasons for this, not least the impact of COVID. And we're still experiencing the washout from COVID policies, which did a lot to undermine what you rightly say. Most people in our services come to them because they want to care for people. They want to make a difference to people's lives. Yet everything from the COVID restrictions undermined that. And we're still living that legacy. So we've got to grasp it. And I have experience, I have hard experience working with 600 families across Europe and the US with an amazing family support group for a rare disease that I specialized in when I was at Great Ormond Street Hospital for Children in London. And we've listened to these 600 families of their experiences of the journey through when they discovered, instead of having a beautiful, bonny, bouncing baby, someone said, sorry, guys, you've got a baby with a major problem that's going to be lifelong. And they tell us that compassion just was not embedded in these famous hospitals. And they saw that staff didn't know, didn't understand the grief they were going through over their loss of their expected lovely child. And then they told us particularly how awful the bad news was conveyed. Often in a room with a curtain, with limited privacy, sometimes on a corridor, sometimes on a telephone, often by an arrogant consultant standing over them with a white coat, not understanding, not being able to communicate with these families. So I have no doubt at all, and that's just one part of my evidence, I have no doubt at all that there are serious cultural issues in our services that need to be confronted.
Let's talk some more about that, Al. You point to COVID sort of fracturing that compassionate approach, and indeed the change of culture in many of our health structures, in health systems. When you look back over, I guess, the history of compassion, what are some of the things that you point to as where we got lost?
Well, I think perhaps the best way to talk about this is to tell you a little bit about my life, which is a life of love and loss. And you're looking at a man today who is deep in the valley of tears. Deep in the valley of tears over the loss just 2 years ago of my adored wife of 57 years, who died through the cruelty of terminal vascular dementia. And I'll tell you a bit more about her death in a minute. But it had a serious impact on me in the light of what happened to me in my life, starting in my childhood. I'm an ABC, an adult bereaved as a child. And my loving family was torn apart when my dad, died suddenly and unexpectedly when I was 10 years old. Now, that is 70 years ago, so I'm telling you that I'm 81. But 70 years ago, my dad died suddenly. And in those days, the effect of death on children just wasn't thought about. In fact, my dad's death was conveyed to me by an aunt. My dad was in hospital. He'd gone in for a routine operation. The next day, he died. And the first I knew about it, not being allowed to go in to see him, as he was dying at that time, children under 16 weren't allowed into wards. And so my dad knew he was dying, but he was denied the opportunity to see me before he did, and I didn't see him. So the first I knew was when an aunt came to me and said, "Al, your daddy has just died. You have to be the man of the family now and look after your mother and your sisters." Mm. What a thing to say to a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
How on earth could I suddenly become the man of the family? And that, Ian, was the sum total of my bereavement counselling. The adults in my family tried to protect me by behaving as though nothing had happened. I wasn't allowed to say goodbye to my dad, and I was full of grief. I remember a fortnight later, I was in my class at school with a charismatic music teacher, and he was wanting the class to sing. And he made us stand up and sing. He said, "Come on, guys, that's awful. Who isn't happy today?" Put my hand up. I burst into tears. He didn't know how to handle it. Hmm. So 70 years ago, grief in childhood just wasn't thought of. And I now know, looking back on it, it had a profound effect on me because I'm an ABC, an adult bereaved as a child. And there's quite a lot about this in the literature, on the websites, etc. So I, as my action for your viewers, please look up ABCs and ask, is it relevant to your palliative care? And it's relevant to a paper I wrote some time ago in the British Medical Bulletin. And the title of the paper was, "Why Should Staff Caring for Dying Adults Always Ask What Does the Death Mean for the Children in the Family?" Now, that paper's had astonishing reach. I took part in the Michael Enright radio show in Canada, reaching 30 million people across Canada and the US. And the response was phenomenal. An 86-year-old lady wrote into me saying, "Al, thank you for talking about this. I now realize I'd never come to terms with the loss of my mum when I was six." So we know from our work, and we can give you the references to look up ABC, that there's a lot to talk about here. So my next question to you is, do you think your palliative care teams are sufficiently sighted on asking what the death of the person they're caring for means for the children in the family?
I would love to think so, Al. I would love to think so. And I know that's part of our work here at Palliative Care Australia through our colleagues with the Paediatric Palliative Care Project. They're trying to inspire those sorts of conversations and awareness in health professionals. So I would love to think that we're getting better and that we're responding better to children in those situations. Al, what looking over your life, what impact did that have on you? How did that change your adult life through school, through university, through your relationship with Rosemary? How are you able to track the impact that had on you?
Well, it had a powerful impact that I'm only now at my advanced age really understanding for the first time. So there's me, age 10, bereaved, but with the intention to become a doctor. There was no medicine in my family, but I was committed as a 10-year-old to become a doctor. Why? To stop other boys and girls, mummies and daddies dying. That was my childlike ambition. I got to grammar school. Teacher said you could do it. I got to medical school, where I found I was incredibly lonely. I was the only student in the school who was bereaved, with a mum on all state benefits through poverty as a result of my dad's death, from a grammar school, excuse me, in an elite organization with the sons and daughters of doctors from wealthy independent schools. I was very lonely and, looking back, really very, very unhappy, being isolated. And these effects of loneliness, of uncertainty, catastrophizing is another effect that I do know is so prevalent in people who've had an unexpected tragedy. They're always looking for the next disaster to happen. And that was me. Until I realized what was happening to me. So one Saturday night in January 1965, I went to the social event of the week in Guy's Hospital. This was the medical students' hop, the place for romantic encounters between doctors, nurses, etc., etc. And across the heaving dance floor, I saw the most stunning young woman, tall, slim, elegant, long fair hair, etc. I walked towards her. I said, Could I dance with you? She said yes, and she demonstrated the most amazing wiggle I had ever seen. It wasn't provocative. She was throwing her whole being into her dancing. Look, I was hopelessly smitten. And 6 months later, I asked her if she minded if I asked her to marry me. And she said, yes, please. But she understood immediately where I was coming from. And she threw her arms around me in her love. And she said, Al, you can be a brilliant doctor. And I'm here to make sure you do become a brilliant doctor. And so for 57 years, everything you see, you hear, you read about this exotic creature, Sir Al Ainsworth, is entirely due to the love and support I had from my wife. So my message to you guys is, if you have love in your lives, seize it. It's the most important thing you can get. And so for 57 years, I had this astonishing love from Rosemary until 4 years ago, when she started to develop the signs of vascular dementia. And she rapidly deteriorated, but coincidentally, she developed the physical signs of kidney cancer. And I had to admit her to hospital for surgery. Now, this was just the start of COVID. I was told I had to leave her at the door of the hospital. I would not be allowed to go in with her to look after her, even though I was her sole supporter. She couldn't cope by herself. We proved we were COVID negative. We self-isolated, and I went with her to the door, to the ward, and they said, you can't come in. I'm afraid I lost it. I didn't think that I should be let in. Eventually, they did let me in. But by being in, I could prove as a carer, not as a visitor, as a carer, I could contribute to the team looking after her. I could accompany her to the operating room. I was there when she came to. I managed to get fluid into her. We got home 3 days earlier than expected because, as a carer, I was able to cope for her. Now, not surprisingly, she deteriorated even further and very quickly after this experience. I had to admit her to a memory home. I couldn't cope with her dementia at home, her wandering, etc. And then she slipped and fell in her care home and she fractured her hip. I had my second confrontation with my profession then because they demanded she should be admitted for her hip to be pinned under surgery. I refused. I saw this to be unspeakable cruelty. And those are the words I used, unspeakable cruelty. How could I inflict on my beloved wife the pain of surgery with her not understanding who she was, who I was, couldn't possibly understand what was happening to her, and then being rehabilitated back, if at all possible, to a life of severe dementia. I refused. Yeah. I was told I was the first person ever to refuse the pinning of an old person's hip. I demanded palliative care. Fortunately, a compassionate, that's the word, a compassionate GP supported me. Wonderful community nurses came in. They set up a diamorphine drip, and she died in my arms, in my love, 3 days later. But during that time, I saw the extremes of compassion. On the one hand, the care staff were lovely. They let me stay with her to lie beside her. They held my hand as she was clearly dying. They wept with me when she took her last breaths, and they came to her funeral. Compassion way beyond the call of duty, compared with the we can do, so we will do, attitude mm-hmm. of surgeons. So this has been really the main trigger for me in my current purpose in life to put compassion back into compassionate care.
Al, so much to unpack there. And I'm sorry and I'm disappointed that you and Rosemary had that experience. How do you explain the response from the doctors you were dealing with? You're a doctor yourself. These are your colleagues. How do you explain that mindset of them challenging your view of the care that Rosemary needed? How do you explain that mindset of those doctors who challenged you at that time?
Well, the first thing to say, it was unbelievably painful for me to have to behave in this way. But by the best interest of my much-loved wife, I was not prepared to stand aside and be told what to do. But I was fortunate in being a doctor. I knew the system. I knew who to talk to. I knew how to talk to them. But the ordinary, if I can use that word, the ordinary person on the street doesn't know how to do that. So they will be intimidated by these powerful, godlike creatures they see in hospital. And it goes beyond this. Look, I had a study day in our University of Exeter, and they have a training school for radiographers there. And I had an afternoon with them, and they told me of their training, etc. And they told me of something I was completely unaware of. They reminded me that 95% of all patients in every hospital go through the X-ray department. And so they have eyes and ears. And what one thing they were so concerned about was unnecessary tests, especially at the end of life. And they thought this was something that had to be confronted against the opposition of many of their senior radiological colleagues who didn't understand this. People being exposed sometimes to difficult, frightening investigations, MRIs, whatever, sometimes radiotherapy towards the end of life. Unnecessary. Nobody was asking, why are we doing this other than to tick a box? Somebody thought it would be a good idea. So I am also coupling onto my experience this new revelation to me of unnecessary tests. And is that prevalent in your palliative care networks, I wonder?
I'm sure it is, Al. We hear that anecdotally as well. And indeed, there's a growing body of research around that unnecessary testing that you point to that causes distress and limits people's quality of life at the end of life.
Exactly right. The radiographers also told me they were concerned about how unprepared people were for their investigations, whether it was radiotherapy or radiological investigations. They came to have an MRI, they came to have some therapy, and they were unprepared for it. And so these radiographers have come together to produce a person-centered narrative for how radiography should be done. And I can point to the publication to you and your colleagues. But perhaps I could ask people listening and seeing this to reflect, what do you think about unnecessary tests and treatment?
Al, do you think going down that path of unnecessary tests perhaps buys people time? Perhaps for our minds to comprehend what's going on. We haven't dealt with death previously. We haven't talked or planned about the end of our life. And so health professionals and us as patients willingly step forward into this world of unnecessary tests in order to buy ourselves some time. Is that part of this, the fact that we deny death, we don't deal with it when we're in a fit and a fit state and in a better shape to deal with it?
I think that's certainly true. But I think it's also seen to be an expression of failure if someone is dying. Mm-hmm. Because we think that we can prolong life almost ad infinitum. And with the wonders of science we have now, the treatments we can think of doing, even if they were invasive, even if they're painful, even if they may essentially be fruitless, we're in this mindset of the wonders of science, and we're losing sight of the humanity of care.
Yes. Yes. What's your advice, Al? You came to this situation with a background in medicine and the confidence to step forward. As you say, many ordinary people perhaps don't have that confidence. Yeah. What's your advice? How do we face that situation? How do we stare down those doctors, stare down that advice, challenge them?
Well, I think it's a question of finding the willing to begin with. Who are the people who may agree with what I'm saying? And how can they brigade themselves? How can your network identify people who are prepared to think like this? People who are prepared to challenge? People who are prepared to demonstrate leadership? And with their own role models of how they can behave, I think it has to start with us. We can't impose it from above with a policy from your federal or your state legislatures. It has to come from us. And central to this, in my view, is the crucial importance of nursing. And I have to say, I'm dismayed by some of the attitudes I'm seeing coming out in our nursing profession. And my good friend Helen Cowan has written about this in a paper called Have We Forgotten How to Care? And I know that your University of Flinders in Australia, the nursing school, there is writing about their concern over what is coming out of our nurse training schools in the context of caring professionals. This used to be the ethos in nursing. I remember it 60 yes. years ago. And my own wife was a nurse 60 years ago. My mother was a nurse. And so nursing is in the DNA of my family, but nursing is a caring profession. Look, I fell and fractured my hip in Lisbon in December. I was at a family conference and I slipped during the night, the usual old man's problem, getting up for a pee. I slipped in the bathroom. I fractured my hip. I had a big challenge. Did I stay in Portugal to have it pinned, or should I fly back to England with a fractured hip to have it pinned here? I decided to come back. It was a family conference. A wonderful former ward sister of mine showed extraordinary compassion. She said, Al, if you're going back, I'm coming with you. I got back home. I got to my hospital, pinned and plated. But after 4 days, I said to the staff, excuse me, is there a sister on this ward? I haven't seen her. They said, yes, but she's in the office doing her paperwork. Mm. Now, what has nursing come to be tick box merchants who've lost the importance of the ward sister talking to people, actually listening to them, actually by her actions, by her role model or his role model, if it's a male assistant, and of course they're so important these days, but what role model do they show to the junior nurses who see them in operation? So I think we have to challenge the culture of nursing in the UK and also in Australia. Do you agree?
Absolutely. But I think Al, perhaps one of the challenges, and you alluded to it early with your new role about trying to teach compassion, and certainly hearing stories like you've shared with us today, they are powerful teaching tools. But how do you go about teaching compassion to the new doctors, the new nurses coming through?
Well, again, it comes back to the willing. Who are your leaders, locally in hospitals or regionally or whatever? Who are your leaders who are prepared to stand up and say, look, the humanity of care is crucial. What are we going to do about it? And once you ask those questions, you can find resources to start addressing that. And there are all kinds of wonderful books that you can dip into. I think that compassion, as I keep saying, is a hard science. It's not fluffy, perhaps like kindness, but compassion is a hard science that can be taught. In Canada, they have toolkits for measuring compassion. I think as a group, we should be looking at this. Can we even design our own toolkit so that your guys at the front line in your hospitals can use this toolkit to audit what's going on? And there's a framework for teaching. There's plenty of teaching resources there. But it comes back yet again to the role model that senior staff are displaying.
And what about the structures our doctors and nurses, our health professionals work in? You mentioned there that the nurse buried in paperwork, unable to be on the ward and be with patients. Do our health structures need to change as well?
Yes, they do. I think it's a cultural transformation. I want a momentum for compassion. And it goes back to the earliest of our stages of trainees. We've got to get into the nurse training schools and to the medical student arenas. And I think I mentioned Melbourne, University of Melbourne, the medical students yes. there with a deaf and dying initiative to improve communication skills. There's a very useful start. So that needs to be disseminated across all the medical schools in Australia. And I'll do my best to disseminate it worldwide. So how do your practitioners in palliative care, and I'm sure there are truly wonderful people, let's celebrate them, let's not get too depressed, there are wonderful people working, but how do we celebrate the wonderful work they're doing? How do we use a media and a comms strategy to get it out there? Because you're absolutely right, death is a taboo subject. And we don't like talking about it. But I'd steer you towards this lovely, wonderful hospice that I work with here in England called Dorothy House. And I can give you the reference. And they have this extraordinary initiative called Part of Life. They leave out of the title, Death is Part of Life. But it's called Part of Life. And they're trying to provide a more open forum to discuss openly death and dying. I mean, death is the only certainty in our lives. Yet we have forgotten about it in our in our culture. During my trip to Australia, I had a 10-day expedition to the Kimberley. I went into the wilderness, and my goodness, if it's not on your bucket list, you must go there and see the Kimberley. But during my 10 days, I saw an Aboriginal man who was part of the crew. And I made it my business to talk to him. I sat down and said, would you mind if, with respect, we could have a conversation? I'd like to hear more about your life, what happens in your tribes, etc. He was gobsmacked that somebody like me would ask to sit down with respect to listen to him. So we did that for 2 hours. He told me of his life and his tribe in the north of the Kimberley. And what he told me about their rituals around birth and the rituals around death, I thought were simply stunning. For example, end of life, he told me when someone dies, all of the tribe, all of the people from miles around will come together to celebrate that person's death, can last for days or sometimes weeks. And children are part of this. The smoking out ceremony to light fragrant shrubs, etc., for the smoke to ease the passing of the spirit, and how they celebrated this dead person. Now, the only other place I've seen something like this is in Ireland, where in Ireland they still have the wake, which is when the whole community comes together with children, with the dead person, to celebrate that person's life. But I'm sorry to say, in secular England, that's gone completely. We'd rather not talk about it. We cross the road rather than talk to someone we know.
Yes.
So we must somehow open up the debate about death and dying. And I also suggest this should be in schools as part of their social education program to open a dialogue. Because here's another point. Death will affect every school. It'll be the death of a student, the death of a parent, death of a member of staff, a tragedy on a school trip, whatever. So every school should be prepared for death. And sadly, so many of them are not prepared. So how do we engage with kids of different ages? There's no one size fits all. How do you engage with kids of different ages to talk much more openly about death and dying? And how do we support those who are suffering grief and bereavement? I've got a wonderful book here. I'll show it to you. It's called The Grieving Brain, and it's by Mary Frances O'Connor. And it's putting together all the new research on scanning grieving people's brains to see how the brain is reacting to grief. And what she is uncovering and exposing explains my reactions now 2 years in the Valley of Tears. And the brain has to undergo structural and functional changes in the grieving process. And I experienced anticipatory grief before Rosemary died. Yep. I saw this beautiful person unraveling in front of me. And that's mm-hmm. anticipatory grief. So are your guys mm-hmm. focused on anticipatory grief before the final death? So I think this new neuroscience explains why it takes so much time for the brain to rewire with new pathways for people who are grieving. And so I propose to you that your palliative care teams really need to become world experts in the science of grief, to understand it, what's happening, how can they modify their approaches to deal with grieving people of all ages.
Al, I'm so grateful to have shared this time with you. There is much to do. Your work and your life inspire it all, and we'll do our best to try and capture as many links and as much extra information as we possibly can in the show notes to help people on their own thinking and their own journey with the critical issues that you raise. I have no doubt you've signed up a whole bunch of people to the Momentum for Compassion. I'm one of them, a new recruit, and it's a worldwide thing. This isn't just something in the UK. Yep. It's something in Australia and every nation that we need to deal with and respond to. And I'm just so grateful to spend this time with you, Al, and to remember Rosemary, your beloved wife, and do her life and death justice in a way. And talk about her and the experience she had so that others can have something better.
Well, thank you, Ian. And, of course, talking about it as part of my own healing process.
Yes.
James Pennebaker, the American psychologist, talks about his research on the healing power of creative writing, which mm-hmm. is why I've written some pieces on anticipatory grief, etc. So I've got three A's to leave with you. The yes. first, through your network, to raise awareness of the crucial importance of being much more open and talking about death and dying. My second A is to activate, not just to sit back and wait for things to happen. And my third A is actions. What actions can you do? So I ask every one of you listening and seeing this today, what one action are you going to do tomorrow that you hadn't thought of doing before hearing this rant from Al? And my final point is, please see me to be a resource to help, support, to challenge, whatever, in any way I possibly can, because as you rightly said, I'm doing this in honor of and celebration of the wonderful love I had for 57 years. And by the way, I have no doubt that my early experience of childhood grief has profoundly influenced my reactions as an adult experiencing the death of a partner. I now know my reaction was hyperactive. It was hypersensitive when I saw anticipatory grief and then when she died. I went to pieces. I had to have support to help me throughout immediate grieving period. And I'm using these events, including this wonderful conversation with you, Ian, to be part of my healing process.
Well, you've started something. This is just the start of something so much bigger. Thank you so much for spending this time with us. We wish you well. This won't be the last time we talk or work together, I'm sure. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ian. Lovely to talk to you and your teams.
Sir Albert Ainsley Green, thank you so much for tuning in to Thursdays at 3, whether that's via PCA socials or Spotify, and engaging in matters of life and death. You'll find advice, tools and support at the Palliative Care Australia website, where you can also make a donation to support our work. See you next Thursday.